This is Digital Story Podcast number 1062, July 28th, 2026. Today's theme is The Lens on the Back Shelf. I'm Derek Story. Having just come off two workshops where participants experimented with gear and techniques outside of their comfort zone, I saw firsthand the wonderful creative results that often follow. One technique along these lines that you can do at home is called the lens on the back shelf. I'll tell you more about it on today's TVS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. I've been urging my workshop folks to try something new, either with gear or technique. So now that everyone has gone home, I decided to do the same with the lens on the back shelf exercise. So what is that exactly? Well, you can kind of guess, right? We all have a place where we store our camera gear, you know, either in camera bags or in cabinets or on a shelf. You know, we have our spots, right? Our cherished spots, I might add. So I happen to have a rugged cabinet, and I like it because it controls the humidity and has a little light inside, and I keep most of my gear in there. But it does have some depth. And what happens is, you know, the stuff that you use kind of migrates to the front, and the stuff that hasn't been used in a while sort of migrates to the back. So I went to the photo cabinet and started digging around way in the back, and I found the Camlan, and that's Kamlan, 50mm f1.1 Mark II optic. Now, I had bought this on Kickstarter years ago when I was experimenting with shallow depth of field for Micro Four Thirds cameras. I had one lens already that I just loved for this purpose. It was the 75mm Olympus, but I wanted something that was a little bit shorter, and so this 50mm, you know, gave me a little bit more elbow room while still having this crazy f1.1 maximum aperture. If you're not familiar with the Camlan lens, and a lot of people aren't, right, it's kind of esoteric in a sense. I think it was on Kickstarter where I saw it, and I think that's where I purchased it as well. And it was super affordable. It was like $140 or something like that. But it's really a quality optic. I mean, it's crazy. Its manual focusing ring is smooth and very well damped, and it's very easy just to get just the right focus that you want with it. It has a clickless aperture ring, and it's well marked, and it even has depth of field marks on it in both meters and feet. And then it has this crazy, beautiful, large front objective lens and a screw-in metal hood. So it has like a lot of nice features, and the pictures from it are quite good. When I was really getting into it, when I was using it quite a bit, I used it for portrait shots. I used it for close-ups, you know, where you really want the depth of field to fall off quickly. I was using it for all sorts of great effect type shots and just loved it. But over time, you know, sometimes these lenses that we get, especially when we get them for a specific purpose, sometimes they just sort of fall out of favor. We forget about them, and they just sort of wander to the back of the cabinet. So I was thinking, okay, since I need to photograph the Panasonic L10 for a live view article that I'm working on, I decided, well, let's use the Camlan, right? Let's take it for a spin. I could do the article shot first and then play around with the wide aperture stuff for my experimental fun. And I really wanted to create something different. I mounted that 50mm f1.1 on my OM system OM1 and switched to manual exposure mode. And it was crazy. When I first put the camera up to my eye and looked at the L10 that I had in the light box, it was like looking into another world at first. And I think I had it wide open. That was probably why. First, I did the product shot, so I had to stop it down all the way to f/16 to do the product shot. And, you know, the shot that I wanted was the lens extended from the L10, you know, so you could really read the Leica and the, you know, the aperture and all that good stuff. And then I wanted the camera also to be clear, but not super sharp. You know, I wanted it to fall off just a little bit, just a little bit. And it was a good thing that I wanted just a little bit of fall off, because even at f/16, it has just the right amount when you go from the front of the lens, which is super sharp, and as you work your way back through the photo. And the product shot turned out really lovely. I like it a lot. And by the way, those of you that follow LiveView on medium.com, that article is up right now, and it's a behind the scenes with the Panasonic L10 during our workshop that we just completed. We did all sorts of stuff. We went to a Russian River Brewing Company, to the town square in Healdsburg, and we did 2 days of covering the Sonoma County Hot Air Balloon Festival. So I had lots of opportunities to shoot with the L10 in all these different environments. And this article that I have on LiveView is about how versatile the camera is. You could just have this one camera around your neck that doesn't weigh very much and cover all these different types of photo assignments. So anyway, and the shot, and the shot at the top of the article of the L10 itself was done with the Camlin lens on the OM-1. Alrighty. So now it was time to start playing. I moved the aperture all the way over to f1.1. And it was crazy. Even with a Micro Four Thirds sensor, the fall off is just nuts. I mean, it falls off so fast that if I didn't have the front of the lens that said Leica perfectly parallel to the bottom part of the lens where it has the aperture and the millimeters and all that kind of stuff, then I couldn't get both in focus. I mean, it was, the fall off is that fast. So I was playing around with it at f1.1 and just created this really fun, lovely shot. Now, I put the shot at f1.1 in the show notes. So it's hanging out there, and you can go over and see it when you go over there to get the URLs for the camera news and all that kind of stuff. And I decided after doing that shoot that I'm just going to leave that lens on the OM-1 for a bit, because tomorrow morning I want to do some flower shots with it. I think that would be a lot of fun. And just sort of wander around in the garden with that crazy lens, because, you know, at 50 millimeters, it's basically a 100 millimeter f1.1 lens. So it's got a nice reach, so I don't have to like get down on my knees and stuff. I can, you know, use the flip out LCD on the OM-1 and line up some good shots. You do have to focus carefully. I will say that you do have to focus carefully to get exactly what you want. But the bottom line is that now I've sort of reintroduced myself to this lens that wasn't even on my radar. And I was just thinking that's what I love about this exercise where we all have things that are languishing in the back of the drawer or in the back of the shelf or something that was something that we probably really liked at one time and used a lot, just other things sort of grabbed our attention away from it. But that doesn't mean that it isn't still worth using, and at the same time can maybe kind of get us out of our rut a little bit and get some of those creative juices flowing. I know now suddenly I'm thinking about doing all sorts of short depth of field shots with my OM-1, thanks to this lens that's absolutely beautiful, focuses smoothly, and I've had it for I don't know how long now, and I'm just happy that we're together again. Let's move over to some camera industry news. I didn't do any last week, so I've got a little bit of a backlog here of things that I want to talk about. I'm going to start out with an article that's on DP Review. I have a link to it in the show notes. This is in the opinion section, And the title is the camera industry waking up to enthusiast demand? I think they are. I think they are finally, right? So let me read you a little bit about what Richard Butler has to say here. I've always liked enthusiast compacts, relatively small cameras with built-in lenses, and a decent level of direct control. A camera I can travel with but still enjoy using. But following the Heisei period in the early 2010s, the available options dwindled to the point that it became almost impossible to buy one. However, things seem to have moved on since CP Plus 2025, when we received relatively little enthusiasm from the manufacturers we asked about the prospects of a compact camera revival. The first flicker had already come the year before from a slightly unexpected quarter when Leica announced the D-Lux 8, a refreshed version of the enthusiast model last updated 6 years prior. Then, perhaps more unexpectedly, in mid-2025, Sony updated its full-frame prime lens compact, the RX1, a decade after the previous version had been released. It was not a camera I expected to ever see, as I thought its job as a signifier that Sony gets photography had been served. Now that its full-frame alpha cameras have received such widespread uptake. But while some reviewers insisted that it should have been more ambitious, I found the camera that actually existed to be the one that addressed almost all the shortcomings of its predecessor and added up to an excellent photographer's compact. By 2026, the tone of many manufacturers has changed when asked about the market for compacts. In these past few months have seen the release of two major updates of well-liked but seemingly abandoned models. The Panasonic L10 is a substantial reworking of the LX100 series 8 years after the last model. I brought a larger body and the same rather laggy zoom, but like the RX1 R3, it directly addressed the biggest criticisms we had with the previous versions. So again, while it's easy for an armchair R&Ders to demand more, the thing that you can buy is rather good. And now we have the Sony RX10 Mark V, which brings the latest autofocus and video performance levels along with a bigger battery, better viewfinder to a large sensor super zoom, bringing into sharp relief the degree of which camera performance has continued to improve in the 9+ years since the last version, even if image quality appears to have plateaued or even peaked for now. All four models have been met by derision from some quarters, not helped by the cumulative effect of inflation driving the prices up, in money terms at least. Others have criticized the degree to which these new cameras depend on existing parts or some of their key components. In all four cases, the lens designs date back to around a decade to the often less demanding pixel counts of that time. And it's true that none of these makers have shown the faith in the enthusiast photo sector that Canon and Sony did in the vlogging market when they spent the money to develop new optics for the likes of the PowerShot V1 and the ZV-1 Mark II. But most of them got redesigned bodies and accommodate different batteries to their predecessors, so there's more than just parts bin diving going on. Another criticism we've seen is that you can buy an ILC more cheaply, and this is sometimes true even if you exclude secondhand and end-of-life bargains that no new camera can ever compete with. But even the very few instances where you can closely match the spec of these enthusiast compacts while maintaining a similar level of hands-on direct control and competing on size, it usually turns out that the person making the criticism simply doesn't like the concept of fixed-lens cameras, which can lead to the whole point of such cameras being dramatically missed. I'm not, at this point anyway, suggesting we're entering another golden age of enthusiast compacts. It's clear that the cameras we've seen so far are updates of existing models and not necessarily upgrades to the extent you might hope. Sadly, I don't think anyone is about to put the effort into delivering a larger sensor successor to the Olympus XZ2, which to me remains the high watermark for enthusiast compacts in many regards. But at least for whatever concerns we might each have about pricing or increased size, there are, after all this time, options. I think he makes a very level-headed point here in that the manufacturers indeed are listening, I think, to consumers and going, there seems to be interest. I mean, a lot of that could be driven by the Ricoh GR and the Fujifilm, you know, X100 series. And they're going, wow, they're really snapping these things up. But at the same time, and I think he sort of alludes to this in between the lines, they're not ready to fully commit to designing a whole new camera, a whole new compact camera from scratch, because they're going, oh, we're not sure how it's going to go. We're not sure if we're going to get our investment back. All those questions that I'm sure they debate about whenever they're thinking about a new camera. The fact of the matter is, and I just looked this up the other day because a friend saw my L10 and goes, wow, that's pretty neat. I think I'd like to buy one of those. I looked it up on B&H and they're just taking pre-shipment orders again. Shipping date now is mid-October, mid to late October. Same thing with Adorama. We know Panasonic produced a bunch of these cameras and have full production going right now. So it's not like they're not making cameras, just more people want them than there are cameras available, which says to me that this is what a lot of consumers want. They want this kind of camera, and we don't need to be kind of nipping around the heels and being tentative about it. I think a camera manufacturer can go full bore into this market, create something very new and wonderful, and I think people would embrace it. Viltrox's first Micro Four Thirds lenses promise great value. This is an article on Petapixel, and I have the link in the show notes. Rumors have swirled for months about Viltrox bringing its first Micro Four Thirds lenses to market, primarily focused on the AF 25mm f1.7 Air and the AF 35mm f1.7 Air APS-C primes making their way to Micro Four Thirds. As spotted by 43 Rumors, the rumors were true, and Viltrox announced that it was bringing these two lightweight prime lenses to Micro Four Thirds in China. A global announcement is expected to arrive at any time. Interestingly, there is no word of these lenses or Viltrox officially joining the Micro Four Thirds system. Viltrox could join at a later date, of course, but the company has not done so despite announcing Micro Four Thirds lenses. As for the lenses, they are natively designed for the APS-C cameras, but feature small and lightweight form factor that should feel at home on Micro Four Thirds. The 25mm f1.7 and the AF 35mm 1.7 lenses both weigh just 170 grams, just under 6 ounces, and are just under 55mm, 2.2 inches long. They are compact enough to feel right at home on a Micro Four Thirds body. Even if lenses designed explicitly for Micro Four Thirds image sensors could be even smaller. In the case of the 50mm equivalent Viltrox AF 25mm f1.7 Air, it will be an alternative to something like the OM System Digital 25mm f1.8 Mark II, $450, or the Panasonic Lumix G 25mm f1.7 ASPH, a spherical, at $250. There is plenty of room in the market for Viltrox's new 25 and 35mm primes for Micro Four Thirds. There's also room for more Viltrox Air APS-C lenses to make the jump at some point, like the 9mm f2.8, the 15mm f1.7, and the 56mm f1.7 primes. They're guessing that the prices will be somewhere around $135 based on what they're charging for them in China and the current exchange rates. It's a safe bet that Viltrox's new AF Air lenses for Micro Four Thirds will be affordable options once they are officially launched globally. All right, well, we'll wait and see on that. This is a July 24th article, and today that I'm recording, this is the 27th, I haven't seen anything happen since this article was published, so I think we're still in the wait and see category. I'm surprised, actually, that they went with the 25 millimeter and the 35 millimeter lenses. There's honestly quite a few options for us in the Micro Four Thirds world for those focal lengths. But if they did something that was really cool, like the 9mm f2.8 that would replace the cookie lens, the 9mm f8 or the more expensive wider lenses in that category, if they could do like a 9mm f2.8 for $150, I think a lot of Micro Four Thirds users would jump all over that. We'll wait and see what happens, but in the meantime, there seem to be in the game. We'll see if they actually become part of the Micro Four Thirds Alliance. Few questions still remaining, but it's a good sign because Viltrox makes pretty darn good lenses. I have a couple of myself and I love them. Jimmy Chin says bringing less gear makes you a better photographer. This is an article on DP Review. I have a link in the show notes. Let's see what he has to say. This one really caught my eye. Jimmy Chin is an Academy Award-winning filmmaker, National Geographic photographer, author, and elite mountain athlete. Known for telling epic adventure stories from remote corners of the world, Chin is also a Canon explorer of light. He recently sat down for a Q&A session on Canon's YouTube channel, sharing his insight on his gear considerations and general approach to photography. By the way, there is the YouTube video in this article, so you can actually watch the conversation right here from the link in the show notes. One thing I found particularly interesting was that he's reduced the amount of gear he brings on shoots. Instead of hauling a huge kit, he'll only take a couple of lenses, or sometimes just a single lens. Quote, I found that when you are working within certain constraints, it actually pushes your creativity, he says. It will make you find creative solutions to different problems and challenges that you face on a shoot. Of course, for the type of photography and videography he does, having less gear is also helpful logistically and physically, but I appreciate his mindset of using less to grow creatively. Adaptability is also a key trait, according to Chin, both in terms of gear and overall mindset. Adaptability is a huge part of being a great photographer and being able to roll with the punches on shoots, he says. Sometimes you get really focused on the single shot that you really want, and you're missing all kinds of other shots. So you have to keep your eyes open and your mind open. Chin also recommends looking at a lot of photography and specifically paying attention to many genres, even beyond what you're personally interested in. Quote, look at all the greats. Understand the kind of approach that these different artists have come to their craft, he says. I think that understanding the thought processes of creating images is a really good place to make photography fun for you, because all of a sudden you are looking at the world in these different ways, and then you kind of find your own language, your own ideas, and how you think about a photograph, and that's what makes your photography special. The video has plenty of other great advice too. It's well worth a watch, especially for newer photographers trying to figure out how to move forward. Nice piece, great video. You should watch it. I'm loving his approach and what he has to say here. I'll tell you, going lighter makes you more creative, if nothing else, because you're not totally exhausted when you get to wherever you're going. You know, you're traveling lighter, you have more energy, the creative juices are flowing, and you can get some wonderful shots. I want to cover a couple points on our Virtual Camera Club news. Two workshops, online workshops, we still have openings for. One is coming up in September, and that will be the Lightroom Power Tools online workshop led by Rob Knight. And that starts on September 9th, and it goes through the month. Of course, Rob is an Adobe certified expert. And if you want to make your pictures shine in Lightroom Classic, he is going to show you exactly how to take advantage of all those wonderful tools. Each session is recorded and made available to all registered participants. And then we also have an inkjet printing workshop coming up in November, just in time to create wonderful stuff for the holidays, for holiday gifts, for holiday cards. All those questions that you have always wondered about inkjet printing will be covered and answered in this workshop. And you can also sign up for it right now by going to the workshops page. You can get there either through the Digital Story or the nimblephotographer.com. Hope to see you at one or both of these events coming up. Want to give a shout out to our Inner Circle members and our Inner Circle Bold members. It was a pleasure hanging out with them during the recent workshop, the hot air balloon workshop. You know, we were sitting around in the workshop room, in the lab room, while we were working, and I was going, all right, how many of you are Inner Circle members? I already knew the answer. And they all raised their hands. And I just go, this is so cool. This is what it's all about. You know, supporting this community, participating in the events, expanding your photography, spending good times with fellow photographers, enjoying some, you know, pretty darn good food. And in this case, on this particular workshop, some nice beer too. I mean, this is photography that's both creative, fun, productive. And that's the spirit of the Inner Circle. And I'm so happy to have the members that we do. If you want to join this group, you know, you don't even have to come to a physical workshop. You could join us online. You could just hang out on the Inner Circle site where everyone's talking and sharing pictures. You can do it any way that you want. But if you want to have a little community with your photography, just click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can sign up there. And the next thing you know, you'll be hearing from me and getting you involved with this great group of artists. And finally, I want to thank our good friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. This is the place that you can get not only, I think, the best paper in the business, but also knowledge, templates, tips, and suggestions. And you're wondering what kind of paper would work great with my portrait shoot or my landscape shoot. I know one of the things that we were talking about during the presentation that we just had for the hot air balloon workshop is that an image would come up, especially with these glowing hot air balloons pre-dawn. They were just stunning shots that our photographers were capturing. And people would actually shout out, you know what? I would put that on metallic paper. Or if it was a shot from the square in Healdsburg that had a little bit more mood, I would put that on a nice sheet of matte paper. And a really good shot always got the same remark, which is you've got to print that, you've got to hang it up, you've got to share it with the people that are in your environment. This is the joy of inkjet printing. And if you want to get involved, just click on that tile, that Red River Paper tile that's on all the pages of Digital Story. Get yourself some paper and start making some beautiful artwork. A big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, try something new. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.